Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today says America has always been a nation of tinkerers. That's an unusual word to use, as the definition has two distinct and somewhat diametrically opposed definitions. One is an unskilled person who tries to mend or fix. Second is a person who enjoys fixing and experimenting with machines and their parts. It's the latter definition we're talking about, from early day tinkerers like Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, to Thomas Edison, or contemporary inventors like Dean Kamen. America has always had people who have an innate curiosity about how machines, objects, and things work, and a firm belief that there are ways to improve them. And in many ways, these men and women have led to our country's economic dominance. But today, with intense international and domestic economic competition and a world with more and increasingly complex technology, there are some who say that the days of the garage inventor or backyard tinker are dwindling. Well, my guest today, Alex Foge, decided to investigate. His book, The Tinkerers, The Amateurs, Do-It-Yourselfers, and Inventors Who Make America Great, remind us that there are still plenty of people who are pursuing a good idea or looking for an innovative solution to a problem. And through the course of the book, we begin to understand the mindset of tinkerers who've had the big breakthrough, to understand what makes them tick. Alex Foge is the author of several books, including Right of the Dial, The Rise of Clear Channel and the Fall of Commercial Radio, Confusion is Next, The Sonic Youth Story, and The Empire God Built Inside Pat Robertson's Media Machine. He's a former Rolling Stone contributing editor, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Alex Foge, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
I have to tell you, at the very beginning of The Tinkerers, you tell us a story of something that people used to do probably for generations. But I think in this day and age, most of us are absolutely afraid to. You had broken your BlackBerry screen, and you took the BlackBerry apart and fixed it. This is a classic American story, which has literally disappeared in this last generation. You know, nobody opens up the back of anything. We just go out and get a new one.
Well, that's right. I think that that's something that shifted in our culture, I think, in the high-tech era. But I make the case at the beginning of my book that maybe the death of that kind of tinkering has been premature, because I think my experience showed me certainly that being able to fix something that we expect to have to throw out when it breaks, you know, is not necessarily the case. I tell the story in my book of sitting on my BlackBerry in my car and accidentally damaging the screen. I could tell very quickly that the phone itself was still working, I just couldn't see anything on the screen anymore. And when I took it into my local phone store to try to get it repaired, the fellow behind the counter said to me, you know, I wish I could. I used to be able to fix those, but they don't let us do that anymore. And it's too bad, because it was my favorite part of the job. And I naively figured, oh, well, I can probably get a replacement one for a fair price. And he said, actually, you have to buy a new one, and that'll be about $450. So I walked out of the store wondering what I was going to do, and got the idea to start Googling around on the internet when I got home. And to my surprise, I found on YouTube a number of videos, step-by-step instructions included, on how to take apart your BlackBerry and replace the screen. So I ordered for about $20 online a new screen, and for a couple more dollars a little toolkit that would help me take it apart. And I sat down in front of my computer and watched the video, and within about 10 minutes, I took the thing apart, plugged in the new screen, put it back together again, and it worked as good as new. Mm. And despite my best instincts, I realized I was able to repair my BlackBerry on my own. And so that was a very exciting revelation for me about the continued power of tinkering.
And you use the word tinkering, which, you know, it has a positive connotation and probably a negative connotation as well. Why the word tinkerer?
Well, that's right. I deliberately called the book The Tinkerers to try to recapture that word. It has taken on some negative connotations over time. I think a lot of people regard tinkerers as people who aren't serious about things. You know, there's the image of kind of the old crazy guy tinkering around in his basement and putting various parts together in different ways and never really making anything of value, but certainly entertaining himself. But I argue that, in fact, most of the big innovations that have transformed our country over our history have been done by individual tinkerers who, in fact, were not experts in their field, but rather just were guided by their innate curiosity. And the way I define tinkerers in my book is that they are, in fact, dilettantes, and I mean that in a good way, people who have a fair bit of knowledge about a whole variety of subjects, but perhaps don't master any of those, but also have a real passion for what they're doing. And when they start out tinkering, they may not even know what they're trying to invent or what kind of problem they're trying to solve. But over time, they end up creating some very fascinating and influential inventions and devices and even concepts.
And of course, sometimes they invent things that they themselves don't see the practical application and somebody else does. And that's what happens.
Well, that's true. I mean, one of the historical examples I bring up in my book is Thomas Edison's invention of the phonograph. I use it as an example because, of course, Edison was a classic American tinkerer and was regarded and mythologized in his time as being the Wizard of Menlo Park, a genius from whose mind spouted these remarkable inventions that changed the way we live. But, the reality was quite different. I mean, he struggled, and his assistants struggled mightily over many of the devices that eventually were attached to his name. And with the phonograph, he was one of the earliest developers of a working phonograph. Unfortunately, he envisioned it as a office dictation device, not an entertainment device, and in fact struggled with the notion of it as something people would listen to music on for many, many years, and as a result, never really capitalized on the phonograph. In fact, it was other companies, including one co-owned by Alexander Graham Bell, ironically, that made the big bucks on the early phonographs, not Edison. So, I think the point of that anecdote in my book is to sort of talk about even the greatest of all tinkerers have their flaws, and it's not just about recognizing a good idea, but there's a lot of follow-through that goes into it. And sometimes particular individuals can't see that at the outset, and it's sort of their own journey to figure out where it may end up.
Another theme of the book is that a lot of times when we think of the tinkerer, we think of a solitary person working in a garage, in a lab, wherever, coming up with the idea, or maybe coming up with the concepts of the idea, and then the idea takes shape, but it is a solitary function. And I think one of the people you write about, Nathan Myhrvold, said, if you do one thing in this book, I want you to get rid of the stereotype. It says anybody who invents or creates a new product has tons of help. And the fact you write that Thomas Edison in his lab, he had plenty of people helping him, everyone from very celebrated people like Nikola Tesla to lab assistants. And they were constantly consulting, collaborating, and always trying to create a better mousetrap as they went through the process. How important is this to this idea of tinkering and inventing?
Well, I think it's a very important idea because certainly the ideas of individuals have always sort of spearheaded a lot of innovations in our history. But the notion that these ideas are created by one person out of whole cloth is just a fantasy, because another precept of tinkering, as I define it, is that tinkerers work with what is already around them. So, of course, new devices are often made out of old devices. And Nathan Myhrvold, who was the original chief technology officer for Microsoft and obviously did very well in that situation, has gone on to pursue all sorts of interesting tinkering activities. One of the ones that I mention in the book is a company that he's created called Intellectual Ventures, which is based on the very idea that you brought up, that in fact teams of people batting around all sorts of ideas ultimately get to some ideas that they might be able to put into a real shape more quickly if they're working together. So Intellectual Ventures, unlike venture capital companies, invest in inventors rather than companies. So it's almost like an invention capital company. And what they do is they gather together all sorts of thinkers and idea creators from different industries and try to address some big issues and big problems that the world is trying to solve and see where they can get with them. And they've come up with some interesting ideas and inventions, one of which is a laser bug zapper that helps to combat malaria. And in fact, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has supported this device, and it's just a fascinating approach to solving a problem that in a lot of third world countries they thought was unsolvable. And what I love about it is that Nathan Merval told me that the original prototype was built out of spare parts they bought on eBay, you know, just from old consumer electronics devices. So again, an example of how you can tinker in teams and also tinker with things that already exist. Yep. And come up with some pretty amazing contraptions.
Weren't the lasers from old CD players?
I believe so.
Yeah. Yeah. To me, when I read that idea, it was like I was thinking of a bug version of the Star Wars missile defense system.
Right. Yeah, that's about the size of it. And you know, they've come up with some other ambitious projects that they you know, are in various stages of development. I think one of which aims to solve global warming and some more safe nuclear engines and all sorts of interesting things like that. That you know, you don't really know where you're headed when you start out, and it's not as if you can develop some of these technologies within existing corporations, because you know, you're going to pump a lot of money and effort into them before you ever see any revenue.
And that's the other thing, is that a lot of innovation comes from these collaborative, if solitary, parts, things that are not supported by big business. For all the hoopla about Google and the Google research that's going on, and they're making some interesting products. You have to admit, whether they'll be practical or not, I think you have to commend the company for encouraging employees to do that. But most of the time, big business really can't, it's not the good incubator for new ideas and new applications of existing ideas.
Well, that's right. And I think, you know, Google, which obviously developed a reputation for remarkable innovation very early in its history, is now facing some of the same problems that a lot of other large public corporations are facing. And that is that once you get to a very large size and you have to report on a quarterly basis to shareholders, suddenly innovation and the kind of high-level tinkering that's required to come up with the same kinds of products that helped start the company in the first place becomes much more difficult. Google has made an effort over the years to try to combat that tendency with a program it refers to as 20% time. And the idea is to have everybody at the company spend 20% of their time each week on a project that does not directly relate to their job title. And at least initially, they got some pretty interesting things out of that. I believe the Gmail and Google News and AdSense came out of some of those 20% time projects. But in recent years, it's become much more difficult. And in fact, they've, even just in the past year, pared back and made some of that 20% time more restrictive. And it's not coincidental that a lot of top talent has left the company to work for startups, because a lot of tinkerers would much prefer to be on the bottom floor of a new company than to be maintaining a much larger company. And I think that that's you know, a reflection of the types of people who want to tinker, either for a living or just to chase their dream, as it were. So it's something that even in a very creative place like Google has become a problem.
Let me ask you a question from the tinkerers and inventors you met. How many of them are motivated by the idea of coming up with a big idea that makes a bundle of money? And how many are motivated by idealism, or, you know, creating a better product that will help people, say, in the case of like Nathan Merval, some of the, you know, idealistic issues? And I know Saul Griffith, Dean Kamen, other people you profile, they're thinking about altruistic innovations.
Yeah, I mean, it may be surprising, but everybody I talked to, from what they told me, was really guided by a personal passion to help people and to create new solutions for our culture and for cultures around the world. And a few seem to talk about money-making as a prime goal at all. That said, many of them have prospered from some of their ideas. But I think, you know, my sense is, just from the work I did researching historical tinkerers and also talking to these contemporary tinkerers, that the really personal passion tends to be the most powerful guiding force, because, of course, tinkering is a very risky activity in a lot of ways. There's a lot of failure that typically comes before success. And so while there may be a pot of gold at the end of your personal rainbow, you know, it may take a very, very long time to get there. And I don't think a drive for making a lot of money typically gets people there. You really have to believe in your idea and be fueled by the pure fun you're having in trying to solve whatever problem you've encountered.
My guest today is Alec Foggia, author. He's a former contributing editor at Rolling Stone, author of several books. His most recent is titled The Tinkerers, The Amateurs, Do-It-Yourselfers, and Inventors Who Make America Great. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. You know, this book brings up some very large issues, which I want to get to. But before we leave, I would like to talk a little bit about the huge corporation and its inability to really foster this. And you use the example of the Palo Alto Research Center of Xerox, which has fueled hundreds of major product innovations, but none, practically none, for the company that created the PARC, that's Xerox.
Well, that's right. Xerox's Park Corporation, as it was known from its earliest days, was designed as a sort of innovative research and development wing of Xerox. And Xerox, in the late 60s, was headquartered in Stamford, Connecticut, but this innovation think tank was built and created in Palo Alto, California. And the idea was that, and it was a somewhat radical idea even back then, was that they would finance the ideas and projects of a group of very intelligent and very talented, mostly former academics, who would create new products for the company, but they didn't stipulate what those products might be. The idea was, again, that given the freedom to think and to play and to bat around their best ideas, that they would come up with some truly innovative products, which the company itself would then reap the benefits of. Unfortunately, in a lot of cases, it didn't work out that way. Park ended up being a very successful venture from a creative standpoint. The most famous example of one of their creations was the Alto personal computer. It was one of the first prototypes for what we know today as being a computer. It had a mouse, and it had Windows-like screens. You know, it was a pretty remarkable development. Unfortunately for the folks at Xerox and at Park, the corporate suits back in Stanford just couldn't see how this product might fit into their product line. They were very oriented toward businesses at that point. And one day, a young guy named Steve Jobs was able to get a very extended visit inside Park and got a look at the Alto and was given a demonstration and walked out of there with some real clear ideas of how he might create the first Apple Macintosh computer. And as they say, the rest is history. But, you know, it kind of took a young guy who had almost nothing to risk to go in there and say, well, this is something I can do something with. And again, you know, in that case, Jobs arguably was not the tinkerer. I mean, he was not the technical mind behind those early Apple computers, but he certainly saw that there was value in borrowing certain ideas. And so, in a weird way, the creation of the PC was kind of a great historical example of team tinkering.
Yeah. You contrast that with a person that most of us have never heard of, but we use his product nearly every day, and that's Karl-Heinz Brandenburg.
Yeah, there are a couple folks that I spoke to for the book that are not Americans, just because I felt there were some interesting approaches to tinkering that had produced some products that certainly had changed our lives, but just not directly in this country. And Karl-Heinz Brandenburg is known as the father of the MP3 file. And as any music lover knows, MP3 files are the most common format that we listen to music in. And they also helped create the file sharing revolution that has contributed to the decline of the recording industry. And at the time when Brandenburg was developing this technology in Germany, a lot of American-owned recording companies were essentially trying to squash the technology. But, you know, I have a strong belief that technology usually wins those battles, and in this case, that certainly was the truth. And Brandenburg worked within an establishment called the Fraunhofer Institute in Germany to develop the MP3 technology over many, many years. And it was kind of a quasi-academic but also commercial endeavor. What they were originally trying to do was to create a high-fidelity way of transmitting music over phone lines. But it turned out to be something quite different. But I use that as an example of how, you know, with a combination of public funding and private funding, all sorts of things are possible. I mean, I oftentimes think, why can't this country come up with a truly functional electric car that everybody can buy and use? It seems like a problem that American minds could probably conquer pretty easily if we put a lot of brain power and funding behind it.
You're right. And one of the things this book does get at is some big issues for our culture. Dean Kamen laments the fact that research and development budgets are so small, and it, you know, wasn't that way 30 or 40 years ago. It just seems like in the last, really since about the late 70s, that all of a sudden the investor return has become so important that companies that used to invest in the long term are now geared towards the next 90 days. And it seems like that's a real antithetical to what has built a lot of our institutions in this country.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, of course, we've been through a pretty rough time as a country economically in the past, you know, 5 to 7 years. And so I think that that probably plays a role. You know, companies tend to batten down the hatches when revenues begin to drop.
But they were doing that before when things time for booming. It was all about the return in the stock market for a lot of them.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think that there has developed a certain short-sightedness in our society towards the importance of research and development. And, you know, there are also some governmental policies, unfortunately, that I think have worked against tinkering. You know, that the United States was once the world leader in tax credits for research and development, and now we rank, I think, about 17th. Is in comparison to other nations. So there are some external factors that play a role. I mean, I think that another factor is, you know, in years ago, going back to, you know, the 1950s, the U.S. government was very comfortable in creating partnerships with industry to create new technology. And I think, you know, it's become a little bit of a political football, but I should say also that I do believe that most true innovation does come from individuals and private companies at the outset. But it's also about creating an environment, I think, where the public sector and the private sector work together and acknowledge that we as a nation within this global economy that has developed can do a lot of things to foster that innovation on American shores.
Another big issue you look at in The Tinkerers is the idea that even with all this new innovation, there's not likely to be, because of high technology, whatever, even a big idea that comes to fruition is not going to employ as many people as it would a generation or even two generations ago. And the fact that we have to have a working population that is very nimble and able to be more of a generalist than a specialist, and our educational system is really geared towards specialists, and it's not, you know, perfect in creating very nimble, flexible people as far as in their working life.
Right. I think that you've touched on a number of interesting factors there. I'll take one of them. You know, we talk about education these days in this country in a very specialist-oriented way, and I think there's some concrete reasons for that. You know, particularly for parents, there's a lot of concern about the cost of college and what kind of return graduates get out of that cost. And so there's a tendency to say, well, you should be trained in a specific area as early as you can because there will be a job waiting for you when you graduate. And unfortunately, I think that is not quite accurate. And that's because we see how technology has dramatically changed a lot of industries over the past couple decades, both in the United States and around the world. And so the notion that if you take 4 years or however many years you take on higher education, and that when you get out, that specific job will be waiting for you, I think is somewhat erroneous, because what happens is that the industry may have already moved on by that point, and your skills may not be quite relevant anymore. So I'm a little bit biased. I'm the product of a liberal arts education myself, but I do think that being somewhat of a generalist has become more of an asset once again in terms of the way we look at education. We've become a nation of test takers, unfortunately. Mm. And as anybody who unleashes themselves onto the real world after college knows, test taking and being good at that specific skill isn't really going to help you in the real world.
And you profile a person who's trying to create a school that does exactly that, Gevar Tully.
That's right. Gevar Tully, out in San Francisco, created initially a summer program called the Tinkering School, and now he's co-founder of a legitimate private school called Brightworks, also in San Francisco. And his whole philosophy towards teaching and learning is based on that very premise that, in fact, there are all sorts of manual skills that you can learn while you're learning all of those, from all of those textbooks as well. And so his approach is very immersive. In his summer program, he's had a bunch of kids build their own working roller coaster, build their own suspension bridge.
Wow.
Just astounding. And these are kids, who are pretty young. I mean, going down to age 10 and 11, and he teaches them how to use real tools. So, and young kids are perfectly capable of using a handsaw if taught how to be careful with it. So his idea is really to get children back into doing as well as learning, because, and I agree with this sentiment, his feeling is that kids are born tinkerers. Everybody is a tinkerer as a kid. When if you show a kid a bunch of tools, they'll try to do something with them. So I think one of the things that we need to rethink a little bit about our education system is how to not squash that tinkering impulse. Mm. It's not so much teaching people how to tinker, it's encouraging the innate tinkering they already possess.
And despite a lot of naysayers, there's a lot of innovation going on, and there's the whole maker tradition. You've got fabrication labs, the 3D labs, the virtual labs. People are using this, especially young people. There's a new sort of virtual tinkering going on as well.
That's right, and I talk a little bit about that in the book, trying to talk about physical tinkering versus virtual tinkering, and obviously things like software development are kind of virtual tinkering that creates a lot of value in our society too, and I think uses the same brain muscles as the physical kind. So it's not necessarily glorifying working with your hands. I mean, obviously there are folks who have no other choice but to work with their hands, and would probably prefer to do other types of tinkering as well. So I think there's equal value in both approaches. And just to touch back on another idea that you mentioned before, I mean, we still are a manufacturing country. The difference is a lot of that manufacturing is a relatively high level and requires fewer individuals. There are a lot of robots that manufacture things in this country now. So, that's something we have to wrestle with a bit. But, again, I think, technology can create issues, but technology can also create solutions as well.
Name of the book is The Tinkerers. Alec Voge, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich, for having me.
Alex Voge is the author of The Tinkerers, The Amateurs, Do-It-Yourselfers, and Inventors Who Make America Great. It's published by Basic Books. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.